Welcome to Tech Note. I'm Min Shen. James Horman Jr. is a law professor at Yale University. After getting his law degree, he worked as a clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. For 6 years, he was a public defender in Washington, D.C., where he became frustrated with the lack of education for juveniles. He later co-founded a charter school for youth who had previously been arrested. He wrote the book Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. James Forman Jr., thank you for joining us on Take Note.
Thank you for having me.
Locking Up Our Own is a book looking at the criminal justice system. But African Americans are not just the ones on trial here. You are telling the stories of African American politicians, prosecutors, and activists. And why did you feel like it was important to, as you have put it before, have African American front and center as decision makers?
I'm the kind of person who, when any topic comes up, I really want to see the African American perspective. And I feel like so often, in really almost every topic, either African Americans are excluded from the narrative or included, but with just one perspective. Like, okay, so here's the black voice on this topic. And in the black community, it never feels that way. You always are aware of a diversity of experience, a disagreements, right? Complexity, people arguing with one another, contradictory positions. And I had the sense that that was true in the history of the buildup of mass incarceration. I had seen so many of those arguments, not just in court, also, you know, in the barbershop, getting my hair cut, right? And there's somebody that's like, oh, these guys need to be locked up. They need to be put away forever. They need to be buried under the jail. And then somebody else is in there saying the criminal justice system is racist and nobody should go to jail, right? These disagreements and these different perspectives are the reality of black life. But they hadn't typically been represented on the pages because for the most part, the black experience as relates to criminal justice had been people who are convicted of crime, charged with crime, or victims of crime sometimes. And that's just wasn't the whole story. And so I wanted to tell more of the story.
And you started the book with a story when you were a public defender back in D.C. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, absolutely. I was representing a young man by the name of Brandon. He was a teenager, and he had been charged with possession of a small amount of marijuana and possession of a gun, a handgun. And he pled guilty, so he was facing sentencing. And I was his public defender. I was appointed to represent him. And I had taken the job of being a public defender because I viewed it as the civil rights work of my generation. And so I'm in court with Brandon, and I'm asking for him to be put on probation. I have letters from his school, from a teacher, from a counselor. It was his first arrest. His parents, his mom and grandmother were there in court asking for him to come home. The prosecutor wanted him to be locked up. She wanted him to go to this really dungeon of a place that was called Oak Hill, and that name sounds nice, but it was not nice. It was like so many of our juvenile facilities. It was a place where kids always left out worse than they went in. And the judge that had to make the decision, I call him in the book, Judge Curtis Walker. I changed the names of all the people in the stories, Brandon, Judge Walker, because I wanted to protect my client's anonymity. But Judge Walker looks out in the courtroom. He's got to make the decision, right? And so he's got Brandon, a young black man facing sentencing. He's got a black defense attorney. He's got a black prosecutor. And the judge is black, and he lectures Brandon. He starts to tell Brandon about, he says, you know, Mr. Foreman's been telling me that you've had a tough life, that you deserve a second chance. Well, let me tell you about tough. Let me tell you about Jim Crow segregation. The judge had been a child in those years who told Brandon what it was like. And then he starts to wrap up and he says, so son, people marched, fought, and died for your freedom. Dr. King died for your freedom. And he didn't die for you to be running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and embarrassing your family, embarrassing your community, carrying that gun, carrying that marijuana. He said, so I hope Mr. Foreman is right. I hope you turn your life around. But today, right now, in this courtroom, actions have consequences, and your consequence is Oak Hill. He locked him up. And that, when I thought about that case, you know, I was so upset and angry at the judge. But when I stepped back, I really thought about the fact that the judge wasn't alone in this regard. Right? A lot of people agreed with him. The city council that passed the laws that Brandon was sentenced under, That was a majority black city council in D.C. The prosecutor in the city at the time was Eric Holder. He was the chief prosecutor, African-American man. The mayor was black. The police chief was black. The police force was majority black. So you have a lot of African-American representation. And yet, and still, the racial disparities that drew me to be a public defender were still present in D.C. And so I felt like then, okay, something is going on that's deeper than what I had understood up until this point. Something needs to be explored and written and told about what happened in this country over the last 50 years, how our punitive approach became so entrenched in American consciousness that even in a majority black community where you would think that people would be upset about these disparities, and where in fact many people are upset about those disparities, but even there, they exist. And so that really drew me to want to tell this story.
Emran Brandon was finally sentenced to Oak Hill, the juvenile detention facility you wrote in the book. At that moment, I hated Judge Walker and the entire court system. Most of all, I realized I hated the Martin Luther King speech. That was a really powerful line for me, but it probably sounds really jarring without context. What were the reasons that made you say that?
Well, being a public defender is an emotional job because you represent somebody, typically, who has never gotten a fair shot in life, right? Who's never had the resources that all of us would dream of our children having, who never had the health care, that never had the education, that didn't live in a neighborhood that was warm and welcoming and safe and comfortable, may have had trauma in their own household. So this is who you're representing. And now, if you're a good lawyer, if you're in a good office, if you have enough resources, you become close to them, you become close to their families, you get to know them, you have to do that to be able to represent them. So you're in court with somebody that you care about, and you feel like in many ways, at least in the court system, you're the only one that cares about them. So then to have them be locked up, I mean, that's terrible enough. But them to have them be lectured at by a judge, that's even worse. But then in this case, what for me was so hard about the speech is that the history that Judge Walker was invoking as his rationale, in a way, for locking up Brandon, that was the same history that had made me be a public defender. Right, it was the history of the civil rights movement and wanting to continue my parents' struggle in this new space that took me into being a public defender. And so he's like flipping that on its head somehow. And like I felt like not to be, you know, I don't want to, you know, this can sound wrong because nobody's Martin Luther King, but I'm imagining myself as like the king figure, right? I'm the fighter for civil rights in the story. And then Judge Walker just, like, he ripped all that history and took it for himself. He made himself the civil rights figure. And we couldn't both be, and he had the power. I did it. At the end of the day, he had the power to order the marshals to walk behind Brandon, put cuffs on him, and take him away. And that's what he did, and I was powerless. So that's why I wrote that. I don't hate him now, but I hated him at the time.
You were so astonished. You were maybe feeling a little bit betrayed. But you were also saying that you realized Judge Walker wasn't alone. There were so many other African-American community leaders, church leaders, and prosecutor politicians who would agree with him. Did you extend that frustration when you were writing about them?
I tried hard not to. So one of the hardest things for me about writing this book is that I was trying to write about people, some of whom made decisions that I disagreed with in retrospect, others of whom made decisions that I think if I had been alive at the time, I would have disagreed with them then, but who knows, right? You can't know for sure. But in almost all cases, when I really explored people's reasons and their motivations, in many ways, I ended up being very sympathetic to where they were coming from, even if I still thought the decisions they made were mistakes. So I had to put myself in a headspace of actually trying to listen to what people were saying when you have city council members or judges or prosecutors who are going to community meetings in the 1970s and 1980s, and they're surrounded by people who are saying, you know, African-American people who are saying, like, I can't live in my neighborhood, I can't take my kids to school, I'm afraid to leave them in the park after school, and you're hearing that, then if you care about the black community, right, if you care about black lives and black health and black existence, then I think it's natural for you to have a reaction of saying, all right, well, you know, we got to do something about it. And for a lot of reasons, you know, which we can talk about, their options were limited in terms of what they could do about it, but they wanted to do something. And the thing that they often chose was the thing that was available, which was more aggressive policing and more aggressive prosecution and longer prison sentences. So it was hard. It was hard to write about people who did things that you disagreed with, but trying to write from a stance of empathy and sympathy and understanding.
I want to explore more of that, but I want to come back to one point that you were saying, that as you were a public defender, a lot of times you're representing people who never had a fair shot in their lives. And this seems to be changing, at least in the book, when there was the first generation of African-American politicians. They were elected into the city council, into local governments, when there were local African-American prosecutors. And they were asking for a lot of things. They were fighting for a lot of things. Jobs, housing, education, safe environment, drug program. But you said that in the end, they only got one thing, which is law enforcement. How did that happen?
Well, racism is a big part of the story, right? So this is a story that's about African-American representatives. And, you know, we talked about them being front and center in the narrative. But at the same time, there's no story that you can write that's about black people in America that isn't about the larger structure, the larger American society, which African-Americans do not dominate, right? So when African-American representatives go to Congress and they say, yes, we want more police and more prosecutors, but we also want more jobs, more housing, more health care. We want national gun control. We want a Marshall Plan for urban America. We want the United States government to invest in black communities the way it did in Europe after World War II. When they go and say all those things, they're relying on a majority white legislature, in this case, the U.S. Congress, right, to have empathy and to have care and to have concern. And historically, we haven't gotten that. And so they don't get all of those things that they want. But the one thing that they get, as you said, is the law enforcement piece, the police and the prosecutors piece. And that's in part because that's the part that the larger society wanted to give. If you go today to the state legislature and say, and this is happening in Maryland right now, there's a big debate about whether to toughen the criminal sentences. And you can see some of the same debate. You see some African-American representatives from Baltimore saying, well, we want more investment in social programs and we want these longer prison sentences. Well, they're only going to get the longer prison sentences. They're not going to get the rest of it. So I would say now's the time to really focus on the other parts, the parts that were ignored for the last 50 years.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with James Forman Jr. He's a law professor at Yale and previously a public defender in D.C. He's the author of the book Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. You mentioned that the leaders wanted to do a lot of things, but there were not a lot of options. And there are also a lot of constraints on what they could actually choose to do. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, they were constrained in all kinds of ways. They were constrained by history, right? So African-American representatives have been elected to represent communities that, because of a history of slavery, of Jim Crow, of segregation, of redlining, of wealth discrimination, of employment discrimination, right? Because of all of that history, these are neighborhoods and communities that don't have the resources to protect themselves without reliance on the state. So their neighborhoods, you know, most communities seek to protect themselves not with police and prosecutors. That's not the first answer. That's the answer you turn to when you don't have enough resources otherwise. So that's one constraint, right? That historical constraint. The other constraint is the political one that we were just discussing, which is that they're dependent on Congress and the larger society to meet some of their needs for this greater social investment, right? So they can't have everything that they want. And then the other constraint that I think looms large in the story is the ways in which people are constrained by their imaginations. Really, I think for the last 50 years, we see a story of leadership that's facing real crises, but doesn't have a sufficiently expansive imagination to think about what they could do in response to that crisis other than a criminal justice response. You see that in the book. You know, one of the stories I tell is of a city council member by the name of David Clark, who's not a drug warrior at all. He's a very progressive guy. He fights for marijuana decriminalization when he gets into the city council in 1975. And then 5 years later in the early 80s, heroin has kind of as really consuming the city. And he's getting all these letters from representatives saying, you know, do something about this. There's these heroin addicts. They're outside my door. They're in my backyard. I'm finding dirty needles everywhere. And he takes all those letters and he sends them to the head of the relevant government agency. He gets a letter back saying, Councilmember Clark, we're on the case. And that's great. But who did he send it to? Who did he send those letters to? Remember, the problem is there's an addict in public space. He sends them not to the head of the Department of Mental Health or Addiction Services or drug treatment. He sends them to the police chief. Because like so many people in this country, our reflexive view is, oh, you know, there's a problem of an addict in public space. Well, let's send a police officer to deal with that. And to me, that's a constrained imagination, because a broader, more expansive imagination would say, let's send a social worker. Let's send a mental health specialist. Let's send a drug treatment advocate who doesn't have direct access to jails like police have, but does have direct access to a bed in a good drug treatment program. So those to me are some examples of all of the constraints that limited the thinking of even well-intended people.
And during that time when Dave Clark was pushing for the criminalization of marijuana, it was actually a lot of African-American community leaders who were pushing back against that. And when we look at it today, it seems like an odd idea. But it makes sense back then.
Yeah, this was one of the most surprising things. It's the first chapter of the book, because we know now how damaging marijuana criminalization has been. But when I really got into the story, some of their reasoning made sense, or I could understand it in the moment.
What are those?
Heroin. Heroin had devastated black communities in the 1960s. In 1963, they tested everybody entering the D.C. jail for heroin, and they found that 4% of the people were addicts. In 1967, they found that 45% were addicts. Homicide rate triples in D.C. It doubles nationally, right? So crime and violence and addiction are consuming the community. You have well-known leaders like Jackie Robinson, the baseball great. His son was a heroin addict. And Jackie Robinson goes around to black churches and he says, don't decriminalize marijuana, because my own son, Jackie Jr., started with marijuana and then he turned to heroin. So there's all these messages that are messages of fear, and they're messages of anguish about what the damage that drugs can do to our community. And people were scared. They were scared to take the risk of decriminalizing marijuana because they were scared of what that increased access to the drug might do. If drugs do come and they do sort of start to take hold in a neighborhood or in a community, we're not going to have the same ability to fight it off, because we're not going to have the same funding in our neighborhoods for treatment programs and for mental health programs. So those were some of the motivations that led them to take this strong anti-marijuana stance.
It sounds like it was so well intended. The decisions that they made it for the safety for their community. And you argue in the book that it's one of those steps that are cumulative, that slowly roll around into what we know as mass incarceration today. And did you feel like they could have seen it coming? Would they have known better?
It's hard, right? Because let's be clear, for every debate that I'm describing, there's two sides. So there were plenty of people saying exactly what maybe you and I now, looking back in retrospect, think we would have said at the time, right? These votes were close. There were also a lot of African-American leaders who were saying, no, listen, the harms of criminalization outweigh your fear about increased addiction. This vote actually came up twice in 1975, 1976, and both times it was razor close. So there were people on the other side making this argument. So that would lead you to conclude, well, yeah, they should have known better, right? Because some people did know better. On the other hand, I'm understanding of the people that weren't persuaded, in part because in 1975, they didn't know that mass incarceration was a thing in the future, right? So they didn't know that this decision they were making was this one small brick in what would become, you know, the prison nation of America. They didn't know in 1975 that 10 years later, Congress would pass a law making it that you couldn't get student loans if you had any drug conviction, including a conviction for marijuana. Right? So they didn't know when they made that decision to criminalize marijuana or not to decriminalize it in 1975, some of the implications that that vote would have 10 years later because of other decisions that other legislatures would make. So I'm split. Partially, I think they should have been more farsighted, but at the same time, they couldn't have predicted everything that happened.
You have been advocating for community alternatives. Can you explain a little bit, what do you mean by community alternatives?
Absolutely. So two things to say about that. One of the reasons why I focus on local communities and local politics is that the argument of my book is that we spend a lot of time talking about the national government and the presidency, but actually most of these decisions are driven at local and community levels. So 88% of prisoners in this country are in state, county, or local prisons or jails. 85% of law enforcement, state, county, local, right? So that's where the people are. That's where the influence can be had. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that when I look at some of the innovations and ideas that have helped to save people from mass incarceration, save people from a life of being in prison or being in jail, so many of them are community-based, grassroots efforts. In the book, I write about a young man I represented named Dante, who would be in prison now, but for the fact that a pastor in his neighborhood, who was very, very good with his hands and with woodworking, he set up a little program for 6, 8, 10 boys, young men, on how to build stuff. And he just passed on like his skill and his love, and he created this program. Dante got accepted to the program. For him, that eventually led to a job, and now he's working on a construction team in Washington, D.C. So he was in almost the same situation as Brandon, but he had a very, very different outcome. That was one person's individual decision that he made, right? So everybody's good at something. Me, I'm a teacher. Right. So I try to do it through the classroom. I teach a class in a state prison in Connecticut that's made up of half men who are incarcerated and half men and women from my law school. And so there I'm trying to break down some of the walls that divide those who are incarcerated from those who aren't. Right. Once we get involved in that small personal way, that leads to greater involvement. That leads to greater activism. But it starts with those individual commitments to individual people, and we build up from there.
Your parents met at SNCC, which is the Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee, and they were very involved with the civil rights movement. How do you feel like coming from that family influenced you and your work?
It influenced me at every level, including the answer that I just gave. I never thought about this until you just asked the question, but a big part of SNCC's theory of change in the 60s was local organizing. SNCC view themselves there as they thought the change would come when you embed yourself in local communities and you help those communities develop the capacity to become civil rights activists and advocates themselves. So I think in one way they influenced me because they helped persuade me of a kind of a grassroots local kind of civic engagement as a way of creating social change. They also instilled in me just a commitment to both to fighting hard fights, that believing you could win them even when the odds look long. And they also, you know, instilled in me a belief that you can't, that you will win, that we will create change. For me, it's almost like impossible for me to think about anything that I've done in my life as not growing out of those lessons.
I want to circle back and ask this. African Americans in a long time only got law enforcement out of so many things that they fight for, they ask for. Do you feel like we're finally at a time where they could have that all of the above option?
That's a hard question because right now we're at a moment in the country where it seems like pushing for more expansive social safety net, pushing for a broader commitment from one of us, you know, in society to the next person, to our neighbor, to the person down the street. It seems like, you know, we're at a moment where there's so much kind of harsh and divisive, you know, rhetoric that nobody's really talking about that. And so I feel like there's some rhetorical talk in that direction, but it's not being met with actual commitment of dollars. So at that level, it doesn't feel like kind of now is the moment for that. But things change very, very quickly. The one thing that I do think can happen right now and is happening right now isn't so much on the getting the all of the above, but it is on the resisting some of the harsh criminal laws. So one of the things that we've seen happen even in the last year is a number of states have done things that that pull back on some of the quote unquote tough on crime legislation that they pushed. You know, Louisiana passed a major package of legislative reform just a few months ago that makes parole more widely available and shortens sentences and reclassifies certain things from felonies to misdemeanors. You know, these are all small steps along the way, but they're reversing the small steps that went in the other direction. In Texas, in California, in New York have all seen 20% reductions in their prison populations over the last decade. So when you look at the state level, there's a lot of places where there is real reform happening. I think including in Philadelphia, Larry Krasner won on just such a campaign. So I think we're in a moment where a lot of Americans are waking up and saying, you know, something is wrong when 5% of the world's population has 25% of the world's prisoners. Like, that cannot be a healthy state of affairs. Why would we have the largest prison system in the world? Are we the world's meanest nation? So since people don't think that makes sense, the real question is now, how do we unbuild it brick by brick?
And you're hopeful?
I am, but, you know, I was born into hope.
Thank you so much for joining us, James.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
James Forman Jr. is a law professor at Yale University. He's the author of the book Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. I'm Min Shen, WPSU.